Welcome to this audio digest edition of the Herald Scotland. From Friday the 10th to Thursday the 16th of August 2018. Read by volunteers at Kune Review Prince of the Blind at our studios in the Bishopriggs Media Centre. The headlines in part 1. Commuters may see rail fares rise by 3.5% next year.
Brexit vote has cost Scots families £400 extra in household bills. An article by Alistair Grant, political correspondent.
RBS pays dividend to shareholders while being hit for £3.8 billion for financial crisis misconduct.
This article from the Glasgow Herald, Thursday, the 16th of August. News. US Justice slates RBS for selling garbage and fraud. This article by Sandra Dick.
Fresh call for Alex Salmond to quit Kremlin TV channel.
This article from the Glasgow Herald. Thursday, the 16th of August. Politics. Testing policy descending into chaos, says Labour. This article by Andrew Denham.
Ruth Davidson backs Amazon tax for online retailers.
Boris Johnson dodges burqa row in latest newspaper column.
This article from the Glasgow Herald, Thursday, the 16th of August. Politics. I'm under attack by fellow Tories because I challenged Johnson, says Muslim peer. This article is Herald Scotland Online.
Arts news. Hidden Door Festival needs £80,000 to survive, begins fundraiser. BBC Scotland mentors comedy writer.
Alexander McCall Smith tackles Nordic Noir, Bloody Scotland Spotlight Writers, Success for Underbelly Benefit by Phil Miller.
The Herald Scotland, on Monday, the 13th of August 2018. News. Commuters may see rail fares rise by 3.5% next year. This article from the Herald Scotland Online. Rail commuters are being warned to expect a 3.5% fare increase next year. This would increase the annual cost of getting to work for many long-distance travellers by more than £150. The exact fare rise will be confirmed when the July Retail Prices Index, RPI, measure of inflation, is released by the Office for National Statistics on Wednesday. But economists from Investec and EY Item Club both predict the figure will be announced as 3.5%. The Department for Transport, DfT, uses July's RPI to determine the annual increase in regulated train fares, which come into force every January. Regulated fares include season tickets on most commuter routes, some off-peak return tickets on long-distance journeys, and anytime tickets around major cities. These fares went up by 3.6% this year. In January, the Governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, said RPI has no merit, adding that virtually everyone recognises the Alternative Consumer Prices Index, CPI. Rail campaigners want CPI to be used to determine regulated fare increases, as it's generally lower than RPI. The introduction of a new timetable caused widespread chaos in the north of England and on various London commuter lines. Thousands of passengers are still waiting to receive enhanced compensation. The disruption led to the government vetoing further timetable changes expected in December, which means that upgrades in areas such as the West Midlands, West of England and South Western Railway routes have been cancelled or delayed indefinitely. A Campaign for Better Transport spokesman urged the government to commit to a fares freeze. He said, "Given the mess surrounding the new timetable, the lack of improvements and the failure to deliver compensation, the government cannot go on telling passengers that fare increases are justified." Manuel Cortez, General Secretary of the Transport Salaried Staffs Association, told the Press Association that services are in free fall. He said, "Justice for passengers means dropping the annual rip-off rise and also simplifying the Byzantine fare structure which privatisation has imposed. And better still, end this costly farce. Put passengers before profits by bringing our railways back into public ownership." Labour's Shadow Transport Secretary Andy MacDonald said, "Chris Grayling's handling of our railways is now beyond a joke. The government's failure means passengers have faced truly staggering fare rises, with fares having increased three times as much as wages." Labour is calling on the government to freeze rail fares on the routes most severely affected by timetable changes, go via Thameslink, Arriva Rail North and First TransPennine Express as a small gesture of goodwill towards those passengers who have suffered and continue to suffer the worst of the timetabling chaos. The rail industry has pledged to remove jargon from tickets and journey information for 500,000 train routes next month. A DfT spokesman said, "Any fare increase is unwelcome, but it's not fair to ask people who do not use trains to pay more for those who do. Taxpayers already subsidise the network by more than £4 billion a year, meaning that 38% of our transport budget is spent on the 2% of journeys the railway accounts for." He added that fare increases are helping to pay for extra carriages and services, as well as upgrades on the Great Western Main Line and TransPennine route. Paul Plummer, chief executive of the Rail Delivery Group representing train companies, said, "Of every pound spent on train fares, 98 pence is invested back into the railway, helping to underpin a once-in-a-generation investment to change and improve for the benefit of our customers, local communities and UK economy." Mick Cash, General Secretary of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, said, "This is another kick in the teeth for Britain's passengers, who are being robbed blind by greedy train operators for travelling in rammed out and unreliable services, while the shareholders are laughing all the way to the bank. The continuing scandal on Northern Rail is just one example of what's wrong. The only solution is public ownership." A Scottish Government spokesman said, "ScotRail's fares increases are generally lower on average than those elsewhere in the UK. This is a result of our policy to place a cap that is lower than RPI on regulated off-peak fares increases, whereas the UK government applies an increase at the level of RPI to all regulated fares." This article was from the Herald Scotland online.
Brexit vote has cost Scots families £400 extra in household bills. An article by Alistair Grant, political correspondent, published in the Herald Scotland of Tuesday the 14th of August 2018. Household bills for families across Scotland have risen by more than £400 since the Brexit referendum, campaigners have said. New research by the People's Vote campaign, which wants a referendum on the final Brexit deal, found Scottish families are feeling the pinch because of the falling value of the pound. It said every householder in Scotland has now seen their bills rocket by £417 a year since 2016's vote, with goods such as sliced bread, milk and butter all seeing price hikes. Scots actor Emma Curry, a leading supporter of the People's Vote, said the figures demonstrated, quotes, "Brexit is already hitting everyone's pockets in Scotland hard, and we haven't even left the EU yet," end of quotation. She said, "Uncertainty and the risk of no deal or a bad deal is already having an impact on our economy. That's really frustrating for so many Scots who voted to stay part of the EU by a large margin. Despite the promise of increased funds for the NHS, greater prosperity and more money for government spending, this hasn't materialised. Instead, we're seeing tighter budgets and less money in our pockets. As a mother, it's worrying to see the impact on our daily and family lives. In June 2016, the price of 250 grams of butter averaged £1.36. It now costs £1.79, an increase of 43 pence. Meanwhile, the price of coffee has increased by 26 pence for a 227 gram bag, while bread has seen a 4.5% price hike. The cost of a glass of wine has shot up by 21 pence per glass. Scottish Liberal Democrat leader Willie Rennie insisted that for families across Scotland, Brexit means bills, bills, bills. He said hiking the price of bread, butter and milk would hammer those who struggle to make ends meet. More and more people are recognising that we need a people's vote, putting the power back in the hands of the public, not Boris Johnson and his friends. That's why representatives from all parties should join us in calling for a say on the final Brexit deal.
The Herald Scotland. News. Recorded on the 15th of August, 2018. RBS pays dividend to shareholders while being hit for £3.8 billion for financial crisis misconduct. By senior news reporter Martin Williams. The Royal Bank of Scotland will pay £3.85 billion to settle US claims that it misled investors on residential mortgage-backed securities between 2005 and 2007. The US Department of Justice said it was the largest penalty imposed on a bank for misconduct during the financial crisis. The Edinburgh-based bank promptly announced it was to pay a dividend to its shareholders for the first time in a decade. The DOJ aide that RBS disputes the allegations and does not admit wrongdoing. Taxpayer-controlled RBS said it reached a final statement with the DOJ to resolve its investigation into RBS's issuance and underwriting of US residential mortgage-backed securities. The bank said the financial and capital impacts of this agreement were recognised in the RBS Group and NatWest Markets PLC and other RBS entities' half-year results announced earlier this month. RBS took the opportunity to announce it had resumed dividend payouts to shareholders after ditching them a decade ago. The dividend is worth £240 million and the Treasury will receive £149 million as RBS is still 62% owned by the government. RBS said that in accordance with its intention announced on August the 3rd, it today declares an interim ordinary dividend of 2 pence per share. The dividend is to be paid on 12th of October 2018 to shareholders on the register at the close of business on 24th of August 2018. Ross McEwan, RBS chief executive, said, "We are pleased to have reached a final settlement with the DOJ and that we can focus our energy on serving our customers better and returning capital to our shareholders." This settlement dates back to the period between 2005 and 2007. There is no place for the sort of unacceptable behaviour alleged by the DOJ at the bank we are building today. The penalty was agreed with the DOJ to end an investigation into sales of financial products in the run-up to the financial crisis, clearing the way for the UK government to sell its stake in the bank. The DOJ settlement and the resumption of dividends were two of the last big milestones in RBS's decade-long journey back to normality. RBS reported an operating profit before tax of £1.8 billion for the first half of this year after taking an £801 million litigation and conduct charge. It reported its first annual profit in a decade in February, £752 million for 2017, following a £7 billion loss in 2016. The penalty would take a slice out of the 2018 profits, but it had already set aside money for the penalty. The resumption of dividend payments is expected to pave the way for further share sales. The government cut its stake in the bank by almost 8% in June for £2.5 billion, but Philip Hammond, the Chancellor, was forced to defend the move as the sale left taxpayers with a £2.1 billion loss. The shares were sold at 271 pence each, lower than the 502 pence at which the Treasury bought its stake a decade ago. According to the DOJ, RBS made hundreds of millions of dollars while simultaneously ensuring that it received repayment of billions of dollars it had lent to originators to fund the faulty loans underlying the RMBS residential mortgage-backed securities. The DOJ alleged that RBS used mortgage-backed securities to shift the risk of the faulty loans and tens of billions of dollars in subsequent losses onto unsuspecting investors, including retirement funds and federally insured financial institutions. As losses mounted, and after many mortgage lenders who originated those loans had gone out of business, RBS executives showed little regard for this conduct and made light of it, the DOJ claims. According to the DOJ, RBS failed to reveal systemic problems with mortgage originators' underwriting practices on the loans that were then securitised, despite allegedly knowing how many issues the loans had. RBS reviews of loans backing its RMBS confirmed that loan originators had failed to follow their own underwriting procedures and that their procedures were ineffective at preventing risky loans from being made, the DOJ said. As a result, RBS routinely found that borrowers for the loans in its RMBS did not have the ability to repay and that appraisals for the properties guaranteeing the loans had materially inflated the property values, the DOJ added. RBS never disclosed that these material risks both existed and increased the likelihood that loans in its RMBS would default. By senior news reporter Martin Williams.
If you are blind or partially sighted, or know someone who is, they may be eligible to receive a BWBF Sonata Plus internet audio player, where our podcasts are available. To qualify for a free permanent loan from BWBF of a Sonata internet radio, please contact your local agent. Please note you will need to be resident in the UK, registered blind or partially sighted, over the age of 8, and in receipt of a means-tested benefit, or have a parent or guardian in receipt if you are under 18. If you think you qualify, you can find your local agent at www.blind.org.uk. And remember, when setting up the player, ask for Cue and Review. Now, back to the main programme.
This article from the Glasgow Herald, Thursday, the 16th of August. News. US Justice slates RBS for selling garbage and fraud. This article by Sandra Dick. Bankers and traders at Royal Bank of Scotland joked about destroying the US economy and admitted they were selling garbage to investors in the run-up to the 2008 financial crisis. Damning documents released by US authorities show senior RBS staff routinely misrepresented the significant risks faced by investors in residential mortgage-backed loans, a key factor in the financial crash. They also highlight a shocking lack of concern over the financial mayhem that was unfolding. The US Department of Justice report into the mis-selling of mortgage-backed securities was revealed on the same day RBS was officially ranked as Britain's worst bank by consumers and businesses. The taxpayer-owned bank came bottom of both business and personal banking in league tables based on a survey of customers. In yet another dark day for the Edinburgh-based bank, the US report was published alongside an announcement that RBS had agreed a settlement figure of $4.9 billion, £3.6 billion, in response to its findings. However, RBS has disputed and not admitted the allegations put forward by American authorities. RBS has been dogged by several scandals since its government bailout in 2008, including for the mistreatment of small businesses by its global restructuring group, and most recently a bank branch closure drive. The DOJ investigation probed the mis-selling of residential mortgage-backed securities, RMBS, between 2005 and 2008. RMBS were home loans bundled together as tradable assets that helped spark the financial crash. The documents detail how RBS routinely made representations to investors about significant risks it failed to disclose about its RMBS and show bankers making light of their behaviour. In one startling email exchange involving RBS's head trader, he refuted a suggestion that he was destroying the US housing market by replying, "I am more comfortable with severely damaged." In another incident, RBS's chief credit officer in the US is quoted as saying that the assets were made up of total F asterisk, 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 garbage, loans with fraud that were so rampant and all random. He went on to suggest loans were all disguised to, you know, look okay kind of in a data file. Throughout the deals, the DOJ said RBS executives joked and showed little regard for their misconduct. The DOJ estimates RBS underwrote and issued mortgage-backed securities that have so far resulted in losses worth more than $49 billion, £38 billion, and forecasts another $5.6 billion will be lost. It is not the first time RBS staff have been at the centre of suggestions they acted inappropriately towards customers and investors. The UK Financial Conduct Authority's investigation into the bank's global restructuring group revealed systematic and widespread mistreatment of small businesses left flailing in the wake of the financial crisis, with bankers apparently gloating as businesses battled to survive. The group was said to have unintentionally pushed small businesses towards failure, hoping to mop up their assets on the cheap. The UK bank was the world's third largest underwriter of RMBS, behind Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns. Andrew Lelling, the US attorney for the District of Massachusetts, said, "This resolution, the largest of its kind, holds RBS accountable for defrauding the people and institutions that form the backbone of our investing community." Despite assurances by RBS to its investors, RBS's deals were backed by mortgage loans with a high risk of default. RBS Chief Executive Ross McEwen said, "We are pleased to have reached a final settlement with the DOJ and that we can focus our energy on serving our customers better and returning capital to our shareholders. There is no place for the sort of unacceptable behaviour alleged by the DOJ at the bank we are building today." Meanwhile, RBS yesterday launched fresh anti-fraud advice after dealing with almost 500,000 scam attempts, which could have cost £245 million. Most of the scams were said to involve romance, holiday and ticketing frauds. The bank launched a campaign to help fight online fraud following a meeting with Finance Secretary Derek Mackay, business representatives, security specialists and Police Scotland. Chief Executive Mr McEwen met with Finance Secretary Derek Mackay, Mandy Heyburn-Little from the Scottish Business Resilience Centre and Chief Superintendent John McKenzie to discuss steps that could be taken to stop fraudsters. The meeting coincided with the launch of the bank's Little Book of Big Scams with advice for customers online and in print.
The Herald Scotland, on Monday, the 13th of August 2018. News. Fresh call for Alex Salmond to quit Kremlin TV channel. This article by Tom Gordon, Scottish political editor. Alex Salmond is being urged to cancel his Kremlin-backed TV show after a founder of the Russian punk group Pussy Riot said the channel supported state terrorism. Maria Alyokhina, who is appearing at the Edinburgh Festival Fringe, said that it was awful that Western politicians lent their name and credibility to RT, formerly known as Russia Today. The Scottish Lib Dems said the former First Minister should end his relationship with RT, which has been broadcasting the weekly Alex Salmond show since November. Mr Salmond pointed out Lib Dem leader Servance Cable had appeared on RT and dismissed the call as a silly season story. Ms Alyokhina, who was jailed after Pussy Riot performed a punk prayer to Vladimir Putin in a Moscow cathedral in 2012, said RT was not independent journalism, but propaganda. She said, "This is a huge media organisation with an almost governmental level of budget. Russia Today does not provide independent information. It works for the Russian government." Asked about Western politicians working for RT, she said, "I think it's awful. We can all understand that any politician is an example for people, and that's a bad example. All the Russian propaganda TV channels are not working to provide information, but to provide hatred. Russia Today is not an exception. If they're working with these people, then they're supporting terrorists, because the FSB, the Russian Security Service, are terrorists. They are using terrorist methods. We have a situation where you can go to prison because of a Facebook post or the retweet of a political statement. The FSB arrest people and they torture people. It's part of the system." Scottish Lib Dem MSP Alex Cole-Hamilton said, "When Alex Salmond started his show, I challenged him to feature courageous dissidents like Pussy Riot, who stand up to the Putin regime. And sadly, he shirked the challenge. With each passing day, pressure mounts on the former First Minister to end his grubby relationship with the Kremlin-backed RT, and yet he stays. Alex Salmond was once a formidable politician who commanded respect beyond our shores. His legacy is evaporating and he should end his relationship with RT now." Mr Salmond, who was SNP First Minister from 2007 to 2014, noted that Ms Alyokhina had not mentioned him by name. He said, "Lib Dems and the silly season go together like cant and humbug, or indeed Vince and Cable, just one of the countless Western politicians who have appeared on RT." This article was by Tom Gordon, Scottish political editor.
This article from the Glasgow Herald, Thursday, the 16th of August. Politics. Testing policy, descending into chaos, says Labour. This article by Andrew Denham. The controversial policy of testing Scottish five-year-olds is descending into chaos, opposition politicians have said. The attack comes after the launch of a national campaign to derail the assessments in P1. Under the move, families with children starting school this week have been invited to withdraw their children from the contentious literacy and numeracy tests introduced last year. Some 30,000 postcards published by the Upstart Scotland Literacy Charity have been dispatched across the country through key campaign supporters, including the charities Play Scotland and Children in Scotland, National Parent Body Connect, and the Educational Institute of Scotland, the EIS, teaching union. Ian Gray, Scottish Labour's education spokesman, said schools across Scotland are returning to an SNP omni-shambles. We have a testing policy descending into chaos as it faces a major campaign by parents and a potential teacher boycott. In addition, there are hundreds of unfilled teaching posts across the country and teachers are on the verge of industrial action. Mr. Gray called on John Swinney, the Education Secretary, to suspend the tests. He said we cannot keep defending a discredited policy that is opposed by parents, pupils, teachers and the unions. These tests are driving children to tears and do nothing to help teachers close the attainment gap. Scottish Conservative leader Ruth Davidson also called for the P1 assessments to be scrapped without delay, saying she agreed with the EIS, who want the tests dropped following concern from teachers. Her Liberal Democrat counterpart, Willie Rennie, has already called for a parliamentary vote on abolishing the tests. He said how many teachers and parents have to boycott these tests before the Education Secretary finally listens. A Scottish Government spokesman said changes and improvements would be announced soon following a review of the first year of assessments. He said the Scottish National Standardised Assessments ensure for the first time that all schools will undertake the same assessments, providing consistency and an important means for teachers to identify children's next steps in learning. This is especially valuable in early years if we are to continue to close the attainment gap. Our approach was developed after extensive engagement with teachers, parents, children and academics. Teachers have the flexibility to manage the assessments to ensure that they are a positive experience for all children. The spokesman said there was no formal legal right for parents to withdraw children from elements of school teaching they didn't like. But he added, if a parent did not wish their child to take part, they should discuss this with the school, who have the discretion to decide whether the child takes part in any given activity. The Upstart Scotland campaign encourages parents to sign a postcard, fill in their child's name and send it to the head teacher. The postcard state, I do not want my child to sit the primary one tests of literacy and numeracy. I firmly believe that national standardised assessment of this kind is not developmentally appropriate for young children. The tests in P1 are part of a raft of new assessments to help teachers judge the progress of pupils, with further testing in P4, P7 and S3. The government argues testing in the first year of primary is important because it gives an idea of what level pupils are at when they come to school. First Minister Nicola Sturgeon introduced the assessments as a response to concerns over falling standards of literacy and numeracy and a lack of consistent data across the country. However, critics claim they are too stressful for the youngest pupils. Feedback from the first year of the tests highlighted a number of cases where pupils were left distressed. However, it appears this is likely to be because whole groups of pupils are being tested at the same time, which runs counter to government guidance.
Here at Q&A Review, we're always looking for more volunteer presenters, producers and sound technicians to volunteer with us and help produce our daily talking newspapers for the blind. If you're interested, please leave a message on our answering service at 0141 772 3976 or email us at information@qandreview.com.
Article from Herald Scotland, 14th of August 2018, Politics. Ruth Davidson backs Amazon tax for online retailers. Alistair Grant, political correspondent. Ruth Davidson has thrown her weight behind calls for an Amazon tax on online retailers. The Scottish Conservative leader said it was something Philip Hammond, the Chancellor, should get his department's brightest minds to look at immediately. It comes after Mr. Hammond confirmed he was thinking of introducing a special tax on online businesses in a bid to help struggling high street retailers. Writing in the Daily Telegraph, Ms. Davidson said, "The Chancellor, Philip Hammond, warned last week that imposing some kind of sales tax on online retailers could require the rewriting of international treaties. He also suggested it was something he was willing to examine, going so far as to say Britain could pioneer its own temporary measures until agreement could be reached. It's something he should get his department's brightest minds to look at immediately. The advance of online firms was designed to offer customers a new way to do business. But if there isn't a more even playing field between traditional and online businesses, then internet shopping might become the only choice we have." Mr. Hammond previously suggested a tax on online businesses based on value generated could be the way forward. His comments came as department store House of Fraser fell into administration before being bought over by Sports Direct tycoon Mike Ashley. Business leaders have warned the tax burden on high street shops is disproportionately high. Ms. Davidson said, "The retail sector currently makes up 5% of the UK economy, but pays 25% of all business rates, over £7 billion per year."
The Herald Scotland, on Monday, the 13th of August 2018. Politics. Boris Johnson dodges burqa row in latest newspaper column. This article from the Herald Scotland online. Boris Johnson has sought to move on from the furious row about his comments on the burqa by devoting his latest Daily Telegraph column to proposals to encourage house building. The former Foreign Secretary called for cuts to absurdly high stamp duty and warned of an oligopoly of construction companies reducing the supply of new homes by land banking. Mr. Johnson has yet to respond to allegations of Islamophobia resulting from an article a week ago in which he compared Muslim women in face-covering veils to letterboxes and bank robbers, or to demands for an apology from Theresa May and Conservative Chairman Brandon Lewis. He refused to comment to reporters at his Oxfordshire home after his return from a holiday in Italy, instead emerging from the house to offer them cups of tea. The Muslim Council of Britain is expected to tell Theresa May on Monday that the investigation launched by the Conservative Party into Mr. Johnson must not be a whitewash. In a letter obtained by The Guardian, the MCB said, "We are hopeful that the party will not allow any whitewashing of this specific inquiry currently in progress. Nobody should be allowed to victimise minorities with impunity." The Tell Mama project, which monitors anti-Muslim violence, has reported an increase in incidents of abuse aimed at women wearing the niqab or hijab over the past week. Mr. Johnson was accused of casual courting of fascism by a former David Cameron aide, Lord Cooper. But Brexit-backing MP Jacob Rees-Mogg denounced the investigation launched into Mr. Johnson's remarks as a show trial. And a ComRes poll for the Sunday Express found that 53% of voters believe Mr. Johnson should not be disciplined for his comments, against 40% who think he should. Far-right US activist Steve Bannon, who was in contact with Mr. Johnson during his recent visit to the UK, urged him not to bow at the altar of political correctness by apologising. The former aide to Donald Trump told the Sunday Times that Mr. Johnson had nothing to apologise for and would be a great Prime Minister. Former First Secretary of State Damian Green, who is Mrs. May's de facto deputy, said he feared Mr. Johnson was being turned into a martyr by the alt-right, which would be a disaster for him and for the Conservative Party. Writing for the Mail on Sunday, he said, "I'm particularly concerned by reports that President Trump's sacked adviser Steve Bannon is forming a Europe-wide far-right campaign group and has been in touch with Boris. I hope that no Conservative politician, including Boris, is taking advice from him about how the Conservative Party should behave." Mr. Johnson made no mention at all of the furore in his latest Telegraph column, in which he described the shortage of housing as the single biggest and most urgent crisis we face. Writing as Mrs. May launched her plans to tackle homelessness, Mr. Johnson warned of a crisis of confidence in capitalism if young people are unable to buy a home. He called for a cut in stamp duty and the ditching of affordable housing targets. "This is meant to be Britain, the great home-owning democracy, but we now have lower rates of owner occupation for the under-40s than France and Germany," wrote Mr. Johnson. "That's a disgrace, and you can't expect young people to be automatically sympathetic to capitalism when they find it so tough to acquire capital." This article was from the Herald Scotland online.
This article from the Glasgow Herald, Thursday, the 16th of August. Politics. I'm under attack by fellow Tories because I challenged Johnson, says Muslim peer. This article is Herald Scotland Online. A Muslim Tory peer has said he is the victim of a politically motivated attack from within his own party over his attendance at a controversial Palestine conference because he criticised Boris Johnson. Lord Sheikh hit out after two Conservative MPs demanded an immediate investigation into his attendance at an event in Tunis in 2014, also attended by Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn and reportedly senior Hamas officials. The peer has admitted attending and speaking at the International Conference on Monitoring the Palestinian Political and Legal Situation in the Light of Israeli Aggression, but denies meeting anyone from Hamas. Lord Sheikh, founder of the Conservative Muslim Forum, criticised Mr Johnson earlier in August after the former Foreign Secretary used a newspaper column to compare Muslim women in face-covering veils to letterboxes and bank robbers. Lord Sheikh told BBC Radio 4 Today's programme that he was against terrorism and attended the event in good faith, saying, "I think the complaints against me are politically motivated. I think the complaint against me is totally trivial. I think these people who are trying to complain about me are perhaps doing this because I have talked about what Boris Johnson has said being wrong." MPs Robert Halfen and Zach Goldsmith complained to Party HQ, claiming that attending the 2014 conference was in itself a breach of the party's code of conduct and does nothing to combat the scourge of anti-Semitism, quite the reverse. In the letter, which has been seen by the Press Association, Mr Goldsmith and Mr Halfen, a member of Conservative Friends of Israel, said the event was no ordinary conference. As evidence suggests, this conference was addressed by anti-Semites and terrorists. Conservative Party Chairman Brandon Lewis has previously condemned Mr Corbyn's attendance at the conference after pictures emerged of him at a wreath-laying ceremony at the Palestinian Martyrs Cemetery in Tunis. The Tory MPs said, "We cannot, as a party, rightly and robustly criticise the Leader of the Opposition for his attendance at this conference while allowing the attendance of a Conservative peer at the same event to pass without comment or complaint. To do so would be to indulge in hypocrisy and double standards. In our opinion, Lord Sheikh's attendance at this conference was hugely disappointing and raises significant questions that need to be answered. Lord Sheikh insisted he had done everything by the book and criticised Mr Goldsmith, who stood unsuccessfully against Labour's Sadiq Khan, a Muslim of Pakistani heritage, to become London Mayor in 2016. The peer told Today, "I was very surprised about the fact that Zach Goldsmith had made a complaint. When Zach Goldsmith was standing for mayor in the election, he made some unsavoury remarks about Sadiq Khan. Then the campaign backfired, and I feel that Zach Goldsmith should have learned following his failure to be elected as mayor of London."
Remember, this programme is just a fraction of what we produce. You can access more daily content online via our website, qnreview.com/freepodcasts, for free daily podcasts of the Evening Times and Herald Scotland newspapers, weekly digests of the National newspaper, and weekly full readings of Inside Soap magazine. Now, back to the main programme.
The Herald Scotland. Arts. Recorded on the 13th of August, 2018. Arts News. Hidden Door Festival needs £80,000 to survive, begins fundraiser. BBC Scotland mentors comedy writer. By Phil Miller. One of Scotland's most lauded new festivals needs to raise £80,000 to continue. Hidden Door in Edinburgh, which has been a seminal festival in Edinburgh and helped bring the Leaf Theatre back to life, said it now can no longer survive without the money. Hidden Door to launch a series of funding packages for the public to buy to help raise the money. David Martin, the festival's creative director, said, "We believe Hidden Door is making a real difference to artists and creative people in Scotland." It is creating accessible, engaging experiences for audiences and is leaving a legacy, both to the communities we invest in and the fabric of the city itself, such as with the Leaf Theatre. Hidden Door helped breathe a new life into the previously little-used Leaf Theatre in 2017 and returned to it this year. This month, Leaf Theatre plays host to the Edinburgh International Festival with an evening curated by Hidden Door on Tuesday the 14th of August, with headliners The Jesus and Mary Chain. Irvin Welsh, author and patron of Leaf Theatre, said, "The contribution that Hidden Door made when they worked with us to open up Leaf Theatre last year and showcase its potential made an absolutely massive difference to the Trust's progress. It's important to support grassroots arts organisations who give space and a platform to emerging artists. I really hope they succeed in raising enough money to keep contributing to Edinburgh's edgier and inclusive scene." Jack Hunter, chair of Leaf Theatre Trust, said, "Hidden Door has been instrumental in our campaign to save the theatre and generous in its time and support. We very much hope that it will succeed in its bid to raise funds and remain an exciting and passionate voice in Edinburgh and Scotland's cultural scene." The money is needed, Hidden Door said, to stabilise the organisation and become a registered charity with a board of trustees. BBC Scotland has launched a new comedy writers programme to support new Scottish comedy writers. The new scheme will follow a similar model to the BBC Writers' Room drama writing programme, which partners writers and independent production companies together to develop TV dramas. The Scottish Comedy Writers Programme will partner a writer with a Scottish-based independent company to develop and write a pilot episode script for an original comedy series for BBC One, BBC Two or BBC Three. Taking part are production companies Happy Trap North, who will be working with Bryce Hart, BBC Studios, who will be working with Lorna Martin, Young Films, who will be paired with Kieran Nicholson, and The Comedy Unit, who will be paired with Susan Riddle. Over a period of 6 months to a year, the writers will work alongside their allocated independent production company to develop their idea. Gregor Sharp, Comedy Commissioning Editor at the BBC, says, "Nurturing new talent is absolutely essential to everything we do in BBC Comedy, so we couldn't be happier to announce this joint initiative with BBC Writers' Room. Script development is the engine room of comedy, and it's crucial that writers are given the license to find their voices and hone their craft in a supportive environment, which our excellent producing partners will provide. Scripted comedy in Scotland is at an all-time high, but we're always looking for the next great idea and can't wait to see what the selected writers come up with." By Phil Miller.
The Herald Scotland, Thursday, 16th August 2018. Arts News. Alexander McCall-Smith tackles Nordic Noir, Bloody Scotland Spotlight Writers, Success for Underbelly Benefit. By Phil Miller. The writer, Alexander McCall-Smith, has told the audience of the Edinburgh International Book Festival more details of his new Nordic Noir books. His new book will be set in Sweden and will feature the adventures of a Malmo-based detective and his deaf dog, who can lip-read. The writer of the number one Ladies Detective Agency series and others said he has been inspired by the success of Swedish and Danish thrillers and TV series. "I couldn't resist because of all the enjoyment we were getting from Scandinavian noir," he told the audience in the main theatre. "I think that there is no reason why Scandinavian crime writers should have all the fun, and we should be able to join in." The first novel in the series is called The Department of Sensitive Crimes and features a detective called Ulf Varg and his dog Martin. Ulf works in the department in Malmö, and like all Scandinavian detectives, he has a background that is slightly odd. He has had a difficult marriage. His wife ran away with a hypnotist, he said. Martin is hearing impaired and is the only lip-reading dog in Sweden, but he can only lip-read in Swedish. "I have had such fun writing this book. I wrote it in about 2 months, so it's coming out in New York and London in the spring, and they're launching it as a series." Bloody Scotland, the crime writing festival, has revealed the new writers, which will be part of its Crime in the Spotlight project this year. The writers are paired with established authors as support acts during the festival. The Open University continues its support as sponsor, and authors in the spotlight this year include Andy Muir, a former scriptwriter for Home and Away and Neighbours, who is paired with Irvin Welsh, and Misty Berry from the US, who has been paired with MC Beaton. The other writers are Ian Patrick, who will support Val McDermott, and Denise Mina, Helene Kist, who will support Lynn Anderson, Craig Robertson and Dr. Cathy Charles, Andrew Reid, who will support Frank Gardner, Chris Curran will support Stuart McBride, Alan Watson is paired with Ambrose Parr and Marissa Heitzman. G.B. Williams is paired with Peter James. C.S. MacLean is the support for two crime writers and a microphone. Daniel Smith is supporting Professor Sue Black. William Graham is the support for Quintine Jardine. The noted poet Claire Askew is the support act for Anne Cleves and Louise Penny. And C.S. Duffy will be the support act for The Real CSI, featuring Kate Bendelow with Mark Billingham. Underbelly's Big Brain Tumour Benefit at The Fringe raised over £30,000 for the Brain Tumour Charity. The Fringe producers have matched the £15,000 taken at the box office for the sell-out event at the McEwan Hall. The line-up included Susan Kalman in her only Fringe appearance this year, joined by Joel Dommett, Nish Kumar, Zoe Lyons, David O'Doherty and Rhys Nicholson. Underbelly continues to raise money for the charity. There will be bucket shakers across Underbelly sites throughout the Fringe, and there is now a Just Giving page. Visit www.justgiving.com/underbellyedinburgh.
This is the end of part one. After a short break, we'll be coming back in part two with more great articles from the Evening Times. This is a message from the NFB UK, the National Federation of the Blind of the United Kingdom. What is NFB UK? The National Federation of the Blind of the United Kingdom, NFB UK, is a self-help organisation of blind, partially sighted and deafblind people helping each other to help ourselves. It's an independent, non-political charity that campaigns for greater rights, citizenship and independent living. How does NFB UK work? We have a network of branches around the country where members and supporters can meet locally. The branches keep our members in touch with their local community and represent their views to local and national authorities and society in general. We provide information for our members in Braille, large print, audio and electronic formats. We work with local and national organisations to improve the quality of life for all blind, partially sighted, deafblind people and those whose sight impairment is part of multidisability. NFB UK campaigns to defend essential benefits and social care services and seeks wider provision of these services and equipment to help us lead independent lives. We have local branches around the country and are aiming to open new branches in more areas. What are the benefits of joining NFB UK? You meet other blind, partially sighted and deafblind people with an interest in peer support, campaigning and making a difference. Members decide and shape which issues and campaigns to focus on, and you decide how you want to work on campaigns. It's free to join this year. You will benefit from our special offer of 1 year's free membership. You can receive regular updates and share information through newsletter, e-group and our audio magazine for members. Founded in 1947, we have played a leading role in Articles for the Blind postal concessions, the retention of different banknote sizes according to denomination, and tactile street paving. Current issues. We are currently active in issues around shared spaces and the built environment, disabled students' allowance, social care and rehabilitation, and the NHS and accessible information standards. Join us! If you are blind, partially sighted, or deafblind, become a full member. We welcome sighted people to join as associate members. Any donation you can make will assist us to further our campaigning. For more information, visit www.nfbuk.org. Contact us via post, NFB UK, Sir John Wilson House, 215 Kirkgate, Wakefield, West Yorkshire, WF1 1JG. That's Whiskey Foxtrot 1, 1 Juliet Golf. Telephone us 01924 291 313 or email admin@nfbuk.org. Also on Twitter and Facebook at NFBUK. Now back to the main programme. Welcome back. The headlines in part two.
Analysis. Smart factories will help forge Scotland's future.
The pinstripe column. Prestwick Airport. Time to pull the plug.
Scots growth is double UK-wide rate as manufacturing prospers. By Ian McConnell, Group Business Editor.
Stuart Wayton. Outrage at Boris is a troubling sign of the new illiberalism. An article by Stuart Wayton, published in the Herald Scotland of Tuesday, the 14th of August 2018.
Letters. Principle of religious freedom must have its limits.
Herald View. Improvements must follow rail fare hikes. The Herald View, published in the Herald Scotland of Tuesday, the 14th of August 2018.
Alison Rout. Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Growth Commission Report? By Alison Rout.
This article from the Glasgow Herald, Thursday, the 16th of August. Sport. The SPFL have spoken to Facebook, Amazon and Apple in a bid to get the best television deal. This article is an exclusive by Neil Cameron.
Rangers call meeting to approve £12.6 million fundraising share issue. The Herald Scotland. Analysis. Smart factories will help forge Scotland's future. By senior news reporter Brian Donnelly. Recorded on the 10th of August 2018. Scotland's manufacturing sector has been invented and reinvented, but it has always been at the forefront of world technology. It was global, not locally controlled trends that shaped the way big beasts like the car industry and Silicon Glen were built and dismantled. However, new ways of creating products where industry and academic experts work closely together in research centres and laboratories are now changing the way manufacturers approach the future aerospace, oil and gas, energy and rail, and car industries. If new models of linking manufacturing directly to university-level research to industry like Strathclyde University's Advanced Forming Research Centre can be replicated, it could be a winning formula. In all, the country has led the way through three industrial revolutions: mechanisation, electric mass production, and computer automation. It is hoped through embracing novel ways of manufacturing, Scotland will continue to lead. The Strathclyde University facility is already a globally recognised centre of excellence in innovative manufacturing technologies, engineering research and development, and metal forming and forging research. It is also seen as a critical link between manufacturers in Scotland and global manufacturing innovation and expertise. However, the new AFRC factor will also mean, according to proponents, that the Industry 4.0 technological framework's smart factories will be able to elevate to an industrial scale the changes that in the last 10 years have had such a huge impact on all our personal lives, from embedded AI to the app economy. It is also claimed that the same technologies, together with many others, will change the way we build both products and our economy tomorrow in the so-called Fourth Industrial Revolution. By senior news reporter Brian Donnelly.
The Herald Scotland, on Monday, the 13th of August 2018. Business HQ, the pinstripe column. Prestwick Airport, time to pull the plug. I apologise for returning to the scene of a tragedy, but I drove past Prestwick Airport last weekend. Other than the old plane with no engines in which they practice fire drills on, there wasn't an aircraft in sight. The dream of a Prestwick spaceport seems to be over, as the UK government's followed scientific logic rather than caving into lobbying, and has designated Sutherland and Cornwall as our potential spaceports. We don't need another one. A quick look at the Prestwick accounts, the latest available for the year to 31st March 2017, shows the impact of few passengers and planes, a loss for the year of £8.6 million, and loans from you and me, via the Scottish Government, of £30.4 million. Enough to employ perhaps 1,000 nurses or teachers for a year. The red ink's not going to stop. Prestwick is, very sadly, because I have fond memories of using it, a commercial failure. Prestwick's using scarce financial resources, which could be better used to fund public services or infrastructure, and it's not helping the economy of the west of Scotland. It damages Glasgow Airport. Economic gravity will eventually prevail, and Prestwick will close when some politicians sufficiently courageous are new in their post and do the right thing. The real lesson of Prestwick Airport, however, is to remind us of the hubris of politicians and the capacity of governments and their PR advisers to spin a story to the point where the narrative offered isn't a downright lie, but paints a picture which is at odds with the truth. Here's how the game works. Each year, when the disastrous accounts are released and sensible people challenge continued support for Prestwick, the lines trotted out by a spokesman for the Scottish Government are the same. Prestwick Airport's a standalone community with its own management and board with a business plan which shows it can have a successful, profitable future. Independent accountants found that plan to be sound, and all the money lent to Prestwick Airport, which the business plan shows will be repaid, is being lent at a commercial rate of interest. Each of these statements is technically true, but in aggregate, they present a picture so distorted that it's an insult to taxpayers and to voters. Of course, Prestwick Airport has a plan which shows how it can become profitable. All companies have such a plan. Carillion and BHS would have had them. What matters is whether the plan is realistic or fanciful. Accountants looking at the plan can say whether it adds up. They can point to issues, but they can't say that the commercial assumptions made by the directors in the plan are rubbish. That's simply not their job. To stop governments propping up lame ducks with interest-free loans, the EU sets parameters for the rate of interest which governments who dish out the loans must charge. They label this a commercial rate of interest. This term is laughable. The word commercial, a misnomer here. A commercial rate of interest is what HSBC or RBS would charge, and such lenders are nowhere to be seen at Prestwick. And this sort of behaviour, wasting taxpayers' money at a time of austerity, doesn't bode well for the proposed new Scottish Investment Bank. Politicians making decisions about what businesses to invest in have a truly awful track record worldwide. If the Scottish Government wants to show us it's financially responsible, it should take the tough but right decision to pull the plug on Prestwick. Pinstripe is a senior member of Scotland's financial services community.
The Herald Scotland, Thursday, 16th August 2018. Scots growth is double UK-wide rate as manufacturing prospers, by Ian McConnell, Group Business Editor. Economic growth in Scotland was twice the rate of that in the UK as a whole in the first quarter, revised official statistics reveal. Quarterly national accounts data published yesterday show the Scottish economy grew by 0.4% quarter on quarter in the opening 3 months of this year. This is double the 0.2% first quarter growth in Scottish gross domestic product estimated in June, when initial figures were published. The UK economy grew by 0.2% in the first quarter. Comparing the year to March with the preceding 12 months, Scottish GDP was up by 1.3%. This was slightly adrift of a corresponding growth rate of 1.5% for the UK as a whole. In the previous figures in June, the four-quarter on four-quarter growth rate in Scotland had been estimated at just 0.8%. At that stage, UK-wide growth over the same time frame was put at 1.6%. Comparing the first quarter with the same period of last year, GDP growth in Scotland was 1.3% ahead of a corresponding rate of 1.2% UK-wide. Scottish growth for the 2017 calendar year was also revised up from 0.8% to 1.3% in the latest data, although this was still a drift of relatively modest 1.7% expansion in the UK as a whole last year. The quarter-on-quarter fall in Scottish construction output in the opening 3 months of this year has been revised to 1.4% from 3.5% in the previous GDP figures published in June. Scottish manufacturing output jumped by 2% quarter-on-quarter in the first 3 months of 2018, the latest figures show. UK manufacturing output fell 0.1% in the first quarter. Services sector output in Scotland rose by 0.4% in the first quarter, ahead of a 0.3% increase in the UK as a whole. The quarterly national accounts also reveal strong growth in export volumes for manufacturers north of the border. Scottish manufactured export volumes rose by 3.6% quarter on quarter in the opening 3 months of 2018. Comparing the year to March with the previous 12 months, manufactured export volumes rose 8.7%. Liz Cameron, Chief Executive of the Scottish Chambers of Commerce, said this is great news for Scotland, but concerns remain that the construction industry continues to experience falls in output, with GDP growth also remaining below historical trends. The quarterly national accounts contain major revisions to past construction output, with growth in this sector over 2014 and 2015 now calculated to have been much less dramatic than estimated previously. Economist John McLaren, who runs the Scottish Trend website, said back in 2016, the estimated growth in the construction sector over 2014 and 2015 was 34%, and now it is 6%. He added, the revised figures for the Scottish GDP show a better performance of late than had been previously estimated, but the post-recession performance remains poor, in fact overall worse than before. The huge revisions to construction output are a worry, but at least seem to make more sense than the 34% growth in 2 years that had been estimated earlier. Such large and late revisions make it difficult to seriously analyse Scottish economic performance. Separately, data published yesterday by the Office for National Statistics showed annual UK consumer price index inflation rose to 2.5% in July, having been at 2.4% in each of the prior 3 months. Figures published on Tuesday by the ONS show average weekly earnings for employees in Great Britain in the April to June period were, in nominal terms, up by just 2.4% on the same period of last year. The inflation and earnings figures highlight the squeeze in UK household incomes, which is proving a significant drag on economic growth. Ms Cameron said the increase in the CPI inflation rate had been predicted by the Bank of England in its latest inflation report and thus was expected. However, the prospect of inflation rising again will bring little comfort to consumers, especially given the slowing wage growth observed in the latest labour market statistics. Chris Williamson, chief business economist at IHS Market, said consumer price inflation ticked higher to 2.5% in July. The rise goes some way to help vindicate the Bank of England's recent decision to hike interest rates. The data follows news that wage inflation slowed in the 3 months to June, meaning the cost of living is once again rising at a faster rate than pay.
If you are blind or partially sighted, or know someone who is, they may be eligible to receive a BWBF Sonata Plus internet audio player, where our podcasts are available. To qualify for a free permanent loan from BWBF of a Sonata internet radio, please contact your local agent. Please note you will need to be resident in the UK, registered blind or partially sighted, over the age of 8, and in receipt of a means-tested benefit, or have a parent or guardian in receipt if you are under 18. If you think you qualify, you can find your local agent at www.blind.org.uk. And remember, when setting up the player, ask for Q&A review. Now, back to the main programme.
Stuart Whaton, outrage at Boris is a troubling sign of the new illiberalism. An article by Stuart Whaton, published in the Herald Scotland of Tuesday, the 14th of August, 2018. Ron Atkinson was brave to come out in defence of Boris Johnson and to do so by saying that he thought Boris's remarks about burqas and letterboxes were funny was an important demonstration of what a genuinely tolerant, free and progressive society looks like. Whether or not Johnson was right to use such remarks, however, is debatable. Boris is a curious product of our times, part politician, part comedian, an apparently libertarian chap who occasionally appears to be saying something important, but in a manner that is schoolboyish. His self-deprecating manner has made him both likeable and ridiculous at the same time. It is as if to stand up for basic liberal principles today, you have to do it through the persona of a clown. And in this respect, we get the Boris we deserve, because British society has become remarkably illiberal. We can see this in the outrage over his letterbox remarks about the burqa. Johnson's arguments were essentially this: Denmark should not ban the burqa. It is illiberal to do this, even if you think it is oppressive to women, looks ridiculous, and is alien to your culture. You should not ban it. However, where communication is necessary between people in an official situation, in court, being a teacher, being a student in a class and so on, then people should have to remove their veil and communicate like everyone else. In making these remarks, he also said that the burqa makes women look like bank robbers and that it is ridiculous, in his opinion, that people should choose to go around looking like letterboxes. Following these remarks, the debate we should be having is, should the burqa be banned? This is an important discussion about religious freedom and about allowing people the freedom of conscience. It is a discussion and matter that goes to the foundations of what it means to live in a free society. A discussion that goes back to the 17th century philosopher and father of liberalism, John Locke. In this respect, rather than being outraged by Boris, it would seem far more appropriate from a liberal perspective to be outraged by Denmark's decision to ban the burqa, to fine women who wear it, and to essentially undermine the important principle of religious freedom, something Boris was rightly defending. Johnson was taking a classically liberal and tolerant stance by defending the right to express your religion, but also criticising what he dislikes about it. This is the tolerance of John Stuart Mill, another giant of the British liberal tradition, where tolerance was about opposing the state's right to interfere in your private thought of speech and behaviour, but also about making a judgment. You cannot tolerate something, Mill argued, unless you first think about an issue and are opposed to it. You cannot tolerate something you like or love, only things you disagree with or hate. Or, as the great Enlightenment thinker Voltaire argued, you may hate what someone says but should defend to the death their right to say it. Unfortunately, British society and the British political and cultural elite have become confused about the issue of tolerance, and through the prism of multiculturalism now think about tolerance in terms of being offended. If my students are anything to go by, most young people think that being tolerant means not offending people or groups. In this respect, tolerance, a key principle of freedom, has been transformed into a matter of etiquette. Essentially, to be tolerant today means respecting difference, being non-judgmental and not offending anyone. Consequently, freedom of speech has become increasingly problematic to think, judge, and speak freely about other people and other cultures is to risk offence. To be tolerant today means not speaking your mind, and increasingly means that people who do so and offend are forced to apologise, are sacked, or even arrested. This is the profound illiberalism we have witnessed with Boris, with the Tory party investigating him, whatever that means, the Conservative peer Lord Sheikh demanding he be thrown out of the party, and, remarkably, Scotland Yard Chief Cressida Dick asking officers to investigate whether Boris Johnson's remarks had broken the law. Lord Sheikh and others have argued that Johnson's remarks will inflame Islamophobia, which will lead to violence against Muslim women. On this basis, all negative comments or even jokes about Islam could and perhaps should be banned. Ironically, one could equally and perhaps more convincingly argue that it is Lord Sheikh's comments and those of the liberal media and establishment who stamp down on any criticism of Islam that have heightened the tension around this issue. See, for example, the ex-English Defence League founder Tommy Robinson and the hay he makes out of the silence being imposed on any critique of Islam. The presumption that people will be violent because of what Johnson said reflects a modern-day illiberal and elitist contempt for ordinary people who they see as animalistic. Borison is using dog whistle ideas, they claim. In other words, the little people, the stupid people, are racist and easily led. So censor yourself, be quiet about these matters, and no more jokes, please. Ironically, this idea that we must not offend certain groups, that we must protect their characteristics, is a mirror image of old-fashioned racism that separated people into different categories, some being more feeble than others. In so many respects, the outrage at Boris, not his jokes, should be seen as the problem of illiberal Britain. Nevertheless, we can still question whether a statesman should use jibes, jokes, and put-downs in what should be a serious discussion. In this respect, I find myself irritated yet again by Boris Johnson, not because he is being offensive, but because he is not being serious enough about something that should be understood as one of the most important debates of the day. The debate we need to be having is what is good about British or Western culture, what is important about freedom and liberty. Because all cultures and practices are not equally good. Oppressing women is backward. So too is a society like Denmark's that now does not allow freedom of religion. But equally, a society that does not tolerate different opinions and ideas and even jokes is going backwards. It is illiberal and intolerant. Dr. Stuart Wayton is a senior lecturer in sociology at Abertay University.
The Herald Scotland, Thursday, 16th August 2018. Letters, principle of religious freedom must have its limits. Stuart Wayton's piece on illiberalism, Outrage at Boris, is a troubling sign of the new illiberalism. The Herald, August 15th, is confused. Denmark's decision to ban the burqa does not undermine the principle of religious freedom, which has limits. Having the right to worship the god of your choice in your own way is one thing. Wearing a mask to conceal your identity, behind which you may be a terrorist bent on killing innocent people, is another. The principle of clear identification of persons is more important than the right to conceal your identity, for the first protects everyone, while the second makes their protection uncertain and, by its very existence, threatens other lives, as we have seen repeatedly in the past. Defending the right of free speech is a basic freedom in this society. Boris Johnson hates the burqa because he hates the disguise, and he compares it to the bandits of old. The idea that not offending people should come before freedom of speech reminds me of life in Lewis 40 years ago. A man came to our door and complained that our hanging washing out to dry on a Sunday was offensive to him. We needed the clothes for Monday. Every other day it had been raining. Were we supposed to go without clean clothes to work on Monday because he kept the Sabbath and was intolerant of our difference? Being tolerant does not mean not offending anyone. Every woman in a burqa sends a signal to every man that almost all of her is not to be seen by him. That is intolerable to almost every man in this country, for it sends him the signal that were it not for the burqa, she would be in danger from him. Any woman who comes here should have stayed home or adjusted to the fact that we all know what women look like and they do not need to cover themselves up. The burqa is an intolerant act towards the men of this country. It is offensive to the local men in our population. When a person emigrates to this country, she should not expect to transport every custom of theirs. Some we do not allow, like underage arranged marriage or child genital mutilation, even if the religion approves. The burqa is in the same category. It should have been left off at our border and never seen again. You can still go to the mosque and worship as you wish, but the clothes you wear should fit your new circumstances. You should not be identifiable either as a bandit or a terrorist. That is unwise. Written by William Scott, 23 Argyll Place, Rothsay. Literally minutes after the latest incident at Westminster on Tuesday morning, the first expert was on live TV, mentioning Boris Johnson and his remarks on the burqa as a possible trigger. Suspect held over Westminster terror attack not known to the security services, The Herald, August 15th. So his implication is that the perpetrator, whoever he is, was a perfectly normal, peaceful chap going about his business and was suddenly jolted into this murderous action by the remarks of a generally discredited politician who happened to utilise the rule of free speech and thought in this country and say what he thought. Is this really the stage we have reached? From Alexander Mackay, 8/7, Newcut Rig, Edinburgh. Angela Haggerty is right to criticise the attempt in modern Scotland to dismiss spiritual and faith beliefs. The smearing dismissiveness of spirituality harms us all, The Herald, August 15th. Some of the evidence of Scotland's undoubted religious decline is at the very least debatable and possibly exaggerated. Even if there was nothing else for me to find a glay in the humanist survey of Scottish attitudes towards religious belief, we no longer go to church, but many Scots still have a belief in angels and devils, the Herald, August 14th. I would be sceptical about the supposed finding that 53% never pray. There are surely relatively few people who, in situations of extreme stress, illness or family crisis, do not in the end pray. I think the survey has got this wrong somewhere. Equally, the survey reports a substantial majority who seemingly do not believe in an afterlife. Yet, I have noted on numerous occasions that news stories where people who have just been laid to rest with humanist rituals are then posthumously quoted as having previously stated that, for instance, Mummy will be looking down on her kids and loving them always. I think there is quite a lot of ambiguity and confusion in this survey and in the allegedly non-religious respondents to it. From Gus Logan, 2 York Road, North Berwick.
Here at Q&A Review, we're always looking for more volunteer presenters, producers and sound technicians to volunteer with us and help produce our daily talking newspapers for the blind. If you're interested, please leave a message on our answering service at 0141 772 3976 or email us at information@qandreview.com.
Herald View. Improvements must follow rail fare hikes. The Herald View, published in the Herald Scotland of Tuesday the 14th of August 2018. The relationship between inflation and wages is a complex one, and few of us probably think too deeply about its impact on our everyday lives. One group knows more than most, however, rail commuters. Indeed, this long-suffering bunch are unlikely to be shocked by the recent figures, showing that over the past decade, rail figures increased twice as fast as wages. Those who rely on the train to get them to and from work have been taking the hit for years, with many struggling to make the commute pay. Research by the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, RMT, found that fares have gone up by an eye-watering 32% over the last 9 years, while average weekly earnings have increased by only 16%. The RMT claims commuters are being ripped off by fares that are often far higher than those paid by our European neighbours, and it's hard to disagree with such a conclusion when one examines some of the local evidence, as anyone who commutes between Scotland's two biggest cities will know. Season tickets for peak travel between Edinburgh Waverley and Glasgow Queen Street cost £379 a month, which corresponds to a fifth of the average monthly Scottish wage of £1,929. Commuters between Edinburgh and Glenrothes, meanwhile, face a monthly bill of £256 for the 31-mile journey. A comparable journey in France between Paris and Etampes costs just £66. The average French monthly wage is £2,704. Fares in Germany, which has an enviably efficient rail network, are also significantly lower. And matters are about to get even worse for UK commuters, with news that passengers are likely to be hit by yet another inflation-busting increase next year, expected to be in the region of 3.5%. With many workers still feeling the pinch from almost a decade of stagnant wages, any such rise will only add to the financial stresses. Pay growth recently fell to its lowest level in 6 months, despite the highest levels of employment since 1976. Higher inflation can sometimes signal consumer confidence, of course, but flatlining wages across multiple sectors of the economy mean that there's still no feel-good factor for many, especially with petrol and house prices continuing to rise and uncertainty around Brexit only increasing. Politicians in both London and Edinburgh constantly talk about down-the-line improvements to the rail network. The problem is that the slow pace of change and poor performance of train companies has led to a near complete loss of patience and confidence among passengers. Higher fares again will only add insult to injury. Ripped off indeed.
The Herald Scotland, Thursday, 16th August 2018. Alison Rowett. Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Growth Commission Report? By Alison Rowett. Like a band returning to its favourite stadium, the SNP leadership will be back in the SEC Centre in Glasgow come October for the party's annual national conference. It will be just like old times as fans gather to hear the classics, including Take a Chance on Me, Nicola Sturgeon's solo, and Alex Salmond's Gimme Gimme Gimme, A Job. Think the most middle-aged fun you can have with your clothes on is a Mamma Mia screening? Think again. Unlike other bands, the SNP leadership will not indulge in the tiresome practice of playing songs from the new album. No one will have to rush from the room on hearing the opening bars of Scotland, the new case for optimism, a strategy for intergenerational economic renaissance. That one, known as the Growth Commission Report for short, is off the playlist. Of 32 motions long listed for debate, none looks at the Commission's recommendations, which include an independent Scotland, keeping the pound and radically reducing the deficit. Chris McElhenney, an SNP councillor who failed in his bid to become the party's deputy leader, called the omission absolutely astonishing, adding, "How can we not be debating the biggest contribution to the independence case since 2014? Or to put it less charitably, what is the leadership afraid of?" Ms Sturgeon announced the setting up of the commission, chaired by former SNP MSP Andrew Wilson, in 2016. From that point to report publication in May this year, any thorny questions about the economics of an independent Scotland could be deflected by referring to the commission's work. Let it get on with the task and all will be revealed. It was a clever strategy, the economics equivalent of MGM's hunt for Scarlett O'Hara. The longer the wait, the more anticipation grew. Eventually, it arrived, and it was, wait for it, an impressive piece of work. Ambitious but realistic, measured yet hopeful, bold in its prescriptions and clear in its intent. The Financial Times noted that it outlined a more sober and fiscally credible case for separate Scotland than the Pollyannish vision of the SNP offered ahead of the 2014 independence referendum. Historian Sir Tom Devine said it might have closed the gap in 2014 and resulted in a narrow majority for independence. John Kay, a fellow of St John's College, Oxford, praised the report's competence. Will Hutton, principal of Hertford College, Oxford, and whose book The State We're In did so much to pave the way for New Labour's economic renaissance, also reckoned it would have put the Yes campaign in a stronger position. If these were movie reviews, the posters would have been a starry, starry night. But not everyone agreed that this was the way to a stronger, fairer Scotland. The left said the plan condemned Scotland to a future of severe public spending cuts. The Institute for Fiscal Studies think tank looked at the numbers and forecast at least another decade of current Tory-level austerity. Others wondered why Scotland could not have its own currency. While the leadership made minor moves to answer criticisms, ministers appeared rattled and in a rush to move on. National assemblies to discuss the document were promised, and, fair enough, these will take place in August and September. But these will not vote on the contents of the report, nor do they look like being able to accommodate everyone who wants to have their say. As of a few weeks ago, the Edinburgh event on September 9th was fully booked and had a waiting list, and the Ayr and Aviemore meetings were heading the same way. The party conference in October would have been the perfect place to showcase the report. Media attention guaranteed, a chance to get onto the front foot, appear strong in a traditionally weak policy area. This could have been the SNP's Clause 4 moment. Instead, the plan will be ushered into the wings like some second-rate act that did not live up to its promise. There will be no discussion at conference because a debate, if it is to have any meaning, is followed by a vote, and a vote brings with it the possibility of defeat. Though more than a decade in power, the SNP still acts like a nervous newbie, unable to handle internal dissent, no matter how mild or well-intentioned. It is hardly a show of confidence in Mr. Wilson's report. If it is not robust enough to be debated among friends, one wonders what chance it has in the heat of another referendum campaign. Which brings us to what is perhaps the real reason for parking the plan. By failing to showcase it at conference, the leadership is giving yet another sign that it is nowhere near ready to call another referendum. If it wanted to be battle-ready, it would have put the Commission's plan to the membership as soon as possible. At this rate, acceptance or decline will need to wait until the SNP National Council in December or the Spring 2019 conference. By that point, the way both Theresa May and Brexit are tottering, the political landscape may have changed entirely. Ms Sturgeon had a very good conference last year. Having just lost a third of her MPs in a general election, she might have been expected to come in for criticism. Yet the bonds of loyalty held. She was lucky too in that Theresa May's spectacularly awful conference speech made every other leader look good in comparison. Will it be the same for Ms Sturgeon this October? One senior party figure, Alex Neil, told this newspaper yesterday that the early 2020s was beginning to look like a realistic date for a second independence referendum. That is a long time for Ms Sturgeon to hold the line against those who want a vote now, regardless of what Westminster thinks. On the upside, it is also plenty of time to knock the party's economic policy into election fighting shape. If this vision of an independent Scotland will not fly with the membership or voters in general, it is better to know now. Electoral fortune favours the bold, not the paper shufflers.
Remember, this programme is just a fraction of what we produce. You can access more daily content online via our website, qnreview.com/freepodcasts, for free daily podcasts of the Evening Times and Herald Scotland newspapers, weekly digests of the National newspaper, and weekly full readings of Inside Soap magazine. Now, back to the main programme.
This article from the Glasgow Herald, Thursday, the 16th of August. Sport. The SPFL have spoken to Facebook, Amazon and Apple in a bid to get the best television deal. This article is an exclusive by Neil Cameron. Scottish football chiefs have held face-to-face talks with some of the world's richest companies in their bid to find the best television deal. The current contract with Sky and BT Sports runs out in 2020, and Neil Doncaster, the SPFL chief executive, is expected to announce a new TV agreement before the end of this year. Les Gray, vice chairman of Hamilton Academical and formerly SPFL board member, revealed that the league are a long way down the line to signing a contract which will be hugely beneficial to the Scottish game. Gray said, "I have been at lots of meetings at Sky and BT Sports with SPFL board and it was all positive. We will go out to tender. The new board will be determined when that, and I'm sure that will be this year. I can tell you that Neil has met with our TV rights specialist, a guy called Phil Lines, and in turn they have met with Facebook, Amazon, Apple and Google, to name a few. They have reported back to the clubs in a confidential manner. It is now all about whether these people are ready to come to the party when we go out to tender. They have dipped their toe in the way that we will see what happens. I wouldn't want to put a number on it, but it needs to be a big number for us to excite us and drive the product forward. The television deal is paramount to the success of the league. It feeds certainly 8 or 9 of the Premiership clubs a huge amount of their revenue stream. In terms of percentage of Celtic and Rangers, maybe a few more, the revenue from a TV deal won't be as significant as it is to ourselves. All 42 clubs rely on that revenue to thrive, in particular the full-time teams, so if we cannot get a deal which reflects the value in all of our leagues at this point, it would be very disappointing. Having been on the board during reconstruction of the league, part of the process was to try and distribute the funds in a fairer manner to all 42 clubs, particularly the top two leagues, so clubs can stay full-time, and we've done that. Neil and his board can be unsung heroes because they do a lot of unseen work, which does raise revenue.
The Herald Scotland News. recorded on the 15th of August, 2018. Rangers call meeting to approve £12.6 million fundraising share issue. By senior news reporter Martin Williams. Rangers have called a general meeting of shareholders to finally approve a new fundraising share issue. Chairman Dave King said in May that he was to launch a share issue which could bring in £6 million in fresh revenue. The total number of shares to be bought in the fresh issue is 63,147,137, meaning the value of the offer is £12.6 million. The new issue would increase the number of ordinary shares in Rangers International Football Club PLC from 81,478,201 to 144,625,341. Rangers International Football Club PLC has now called a meeting at the end of August, where final approval will be sought for the issue of shares. In a general meeting notice, the club said the issue of shares will improve the capital base of our company and ensure the ongoing funding of the company is both secure and compliant with all rules affecting football clubs. It comes after shareholders approved the issue of new shares at the 2017 annual general meeting. The board said it was now seeking approval, now that the identities of the participants of the issue and the price of 20 pence at which shares are to be issued have been finalised. The RIFC PLC's recommendation states, "Your board believes the resolution is in the best interests of the company and is most likely to promote the success of the company for the benefit of its shareholders as a whole. The board recommends that shareholders vote in favour of the resolution, as each director intends to do so in respect of his own beneficial holding." The move is separate from the Rangers chairman's judge-ordered £11 million bid for most of the club's shares, which Mr King says has been held up because he has to get funds from South Africa to the UK. Lord Bannatyne issued a warning to Mr King last month to make good his obligation required under takeover code rules at a hearing at the Court of Session in Edinburgh. The Rangers chief had already been told he is in breach of takeover rules by failing to make the bid. In December, Lord Bannatyne ruled in favour of the takeover panel that Mr King acted in concert with other shareholders when he bought a controlling stake in 2015, ousting a board of directors said to be allied to Sports Direct founder Mike Ashley. That supported the takeover panel's view that a formal takeover should have been triggered after the Free Bears group, led by Mr King, secured more than 30% of the voting rights in Rangers. Under takeover code rules, a written offer to shareholders had to be made within 28 days of a bid announcement being made on March the 29th. The general meeting notice confirms the issue will be made to existing shareholders named as Barry Scott, John Bennett, Andrew Ross, Club 1872, Barita Investments Limited, New Trace Limited, Andrew Hawkyard, Neil Hossey, Paul Redburn, New Oasis Asset Limited, Douglas Park, George Leffam, and George Taylor. Mr King's New Oasis Asset Limited is listed as taking the biggest stake, 9,199,089 shares, and will remain the biggest shareholder at Rangers with 21,068,594 shares and 14.57% of RIFC if the issue is approved. Rangers fans shareholder group Club 1872 would remain the second biggest shareholder with an extra 5 million from the issue for a total of 13,732,254 shares, giving them 9.5% of RIFC. A new name amongst the major shareholders at Rangers is Barita Investments Limited, who would get 7.5 million shares from the new issue, bringing the company's total to 11,132,500 and 7.7% of RIFC. The company is believed to be the investment vehicle of Julian Walhart, the chief executive of Hong Kong-based Dihong Capital Partners. Hong Kong-based George Taylor, a Glasgow-born managing director with Morgan Stanley, would strengthen his position at RIFC with an extra 5,870,768 shares, bringing his total to 13,445,768, with 9.3% of RIFC. He remains the shareholder with the third biggest stake. Former Rangers director Barry Scott will receive the second biggest stake from the new issue with 7,645,000 shares. The Hong Kong-based business was named in January 2016 as one of the three benefactors who contributed to the £6.5 million loan paid to Rangers in a bid to pay off Mike Ashley and help pay for the day-to-day running costs. The biggest loser from the prominent Rangers shareholders appears to be former Rangers chairman Sandy Easdale, who left the boardroom after Mr King's Blue Knights took control 3 years ago, but had remained the fourth biggest shareholder. He has no new stake, meaning he would remain on 5,256,110 shares, but he will have a much smaller slice of the RIFC pie, with 3.6% down from his 6.45% before the share issue. A statement on the Premiership Club's website said, Rangers International Football Club PLC has today called a general meeting, GM, of its shareholders at 9:30 a.m. on Friday the 31st of August 2018 to approve an issue of shares. By senior news reporter Martin Williams.
Thank you for listening to this week's edition of the Herald Scotland. This weekly Talking Newspaper Digest was a Q&Review recording service production. The readers were volunteers at Q&Review, and the producer was Jay Kidd. Q&Review Recording Service Limited is a registered Scottish charity, number SC018016. Our registered office is at 18 Crowhill Road, Bishop Briggs, Glasgow, G641QY. Remember, you can always get in contact with us by email at information@qandreview.com or by leaving us a message on our answering service at 0141 772 3976.